I want to go back to Ezekiel 1, and we come to the conclusion of this matter of the vision of Christ. I want to make a comment about this relative to these various parallel passages. The question has come up about why it is that there was such a close parallel in these passages. And the question is it possible that John, for example, copied Ezekiel? The answer to that is that the visions are spoken of enough differently to prevent that. They're quite different, and especially in view of the fact that you're talking about two different languages. There's enough similarity here to show that you're talking about the same person, and enough difference that it couldn't be fabricated, you know, something that one just picked up ideas from the other. There's a deeper sense of it if you read the original languages. Now, going to chapter 1 then, verse 12. And they went everyone straight forward. Whither the Spirit was to go, they went, and they turned not when they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of lamps. It went up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. And the living creatures ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning. Now as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth by the living creature with his four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the color of a beryl, and they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was as it were a wheel in the middle of a wheel. When they went upon their four sides, and they turned not when they went. As for their rings, they were so high that they were dreadful, and their rings were full of eyes round about them four. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went by them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. Whithersoever the Spirit was to go, they went. Thither was their spirit to go. And the wheels were lifted up over against them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. When those went, these went. When those stood, these stood. When those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up over against them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. And the likeness of the firmament upon the heads of the living creature was as the color of the terrible crystal stretched forth over their heads above. And under the firmament were their wings straight, the one toward the other. Every one had two which covered on this side, and every one had two which covered on that side, their bodies. When they went, I heard the noise of their wings, like the noise of great waters, as the voice of the Almighty, the voice of speech, as the noise of an host. When they stood, they let down their wings, and there was a voice from the firmament that was over their heads, when they stood and had let down their wings. And above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne, as the appearance of a sapphire stone. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above upon it. And I saw as the color of amber, as the appearance of fire round about within it, from the appearance of his loins even upward, and from the appearance of his loins even downward. I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire, and it had brightness round about. As the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud in the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness round about. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice of one that spake. To get the overall picture of this is the important thing, to try and take individual words and bring out symbolisms from them leads a person off into speculative sidetracks. And I think we've got to be careful about that. Besides that, it also turns the Bible into a textbook. We become academic about it, which is not sound at all. It is one of the curses of the church today to have numbers of groups of people pursuing an educational knowledge of the Bible. The more they pursue the Bible apart from the Spirit, the more they are fragmented, the more division there is in the church. Pursue the Word apart from the Spirit. To pursue the Word outside the context of what God has ordained. For example, it is a gross error for people generally to pop up as teachers of the Word without the training of the Spirit. There are those that go from radio broadcast to radio broadcast, from meeting to meeting, and become more confused than ever. In the matter of faith, it is even a more crucial issue. The average human being, the average individual, without the training, does not have the capacity to discern, to separate between what is true and what is false. And the great tendency today of Christians to run about here and there and go to this place and that place, try to get many different opinions on it, is faulty because they don't have the capacity to discern that. There are those that are given the Word to teach, those that are given the grace, the anointing to teach. But more than that, there is the need of a shepherd. I don't say that people have to come to me as a shepherd. Far from it. I don't ever push that point at all. I don't ever really encourage people to come and hear me even. But one ought to find someone whom the Lord would lead them to as a shepherd and a teacher, and fellowship and worship with that one. Whatever ministry can be gleaned should be, in some respects, under the guidance of that one. The only reason I say that is for the present emergency, the present situation where there is such a rash of varying teachings. In the old days, in the early church, there were some variables, all right, but generally speaking, there was a recognized leadership, and in that recognized leadership, there is safety. Well, in the church today, there's a recognized leadership in which you would find a certain degree of safety. Generally speaking, the evangelistic activity of someone like Billy Graham is something that the church has been able to rely upon as a good presentation of the essence of the gospel. I can't tell you about his private life, but I can't say that all of those things are as they should be. But generally speaking, there's been a unified presentation of the gospel through his ministry. And I'm really not speaking of the mainstream. I'm talking about the tendency of Bible classes, of Bible class work, to spring up everywhere, led by and taught by ones that have not the training. And of course the idea that, well, the Spirit will give them the training is unsound on the basis that the church has been led into fragmentation. It's the confusion, the proof of the puddings and the eating. Why is there so much confusion in the church? It's the pride of the individual that says, I want to be my own judge of what is true and what is not true. It's that incessant pride that says, I'm not going to submit myself to anyone. I'm going to be my own judge. Now, that is pride and it is wrong. Find a shepherd and be under the shepherd's care. I'm not saying that for my sake. I'm saying it for your sake. Now, it comes up because of this very passage we're talking about. The idiocies that are perpetrated around the country in the name of prophecy and in the name of teaching and so forth are ridiculous. If they weren't so tragic, it would be ridiculous. I was in a certain place of business this last week. It was a fairly reputable store, you know, and I said to the salesman there, probably the manager or owner of the store, I said, now, you know, I appreciate the fact that you know your product. That's why I'm in here. I said, I could buy this for a lot less somewhere else, this kind of thing. But I said, the reason I came to a place like this was because wherever I went, the salesman did not know anything about their product. And so I said, I come here and you know your product, and I appreciate that. So I just wanted to give you that word. And he said something about, well, he said, that's a good word. And then he started speaking about the matter of religion. And he said, you know, he said, I'm into religion. And he said, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. And he said, you know, that's a very important thing for us, too. We know our Bible. No one dares to argue with us about that. There were lots of things that I could have said, but I kept the sword sheathed because I felt that it was not going to go on willing ears. I just didn't feel that the Spirit was in my making an issue of it, and I let it drop at that. But one of the important questions that I would have asked him is to tell me about where they are learning their Greek, because the Greek is totally off. They don't know Greek. They don't even have, I don't think they have a school anywhere. If anybody is knowledgeable in Greek and teaching it out of the standard Greek textbooks, grammars and so forth, he would leave the organization. Because the Greek text will not support the theories of the Jehovah's Witnesses. The English text can be made to support it. The English text can support a lot of things. We were reading a verse down in San Diego last week. Someone said, well, look, isn't that a verse the pantheist could take and use in the sense of pantheism? That's not the word they used. That's what they meant. And I said, yes, of course they can use that verse to support that theory. If they take it out of context, they can easily use it to support it. But that's the whole point, is that you have to study the Word in the context of the Spirit. And you have to study it in the context of the fellowship of the believers. I want to say to you that the Spirit of God will reveal the truth in the body of believers here in ways that He does not reveal it privately. I have observed that even in my own giving of the Word. The Spirit reveals things to me in the Word as I am talking and teaching you here in a body that are richer and deeper even than when I'm studying it privately. Because why? There's a unity of the Spirit in the believers. If you come to this meeting to be instructed in the Bible, you will probably miss it because you can easily misunderstand my words. But if you come to be ministered to in the Spirit, the Lord will combine the Spirit and the Word and teach it. That keeps a person from becoming too independent. It keeps me from becoming too independent. I minister to you as the body. I'm your voice. There is an integral unity here that you will not get apart from coming in the right spirit and apart from my speaking in the right spirit. But just to go and study the Bible as an academic subject will throw people off. And it's this matter of pride that has swept through the church of everyone wanting to be his own guide, his own teacher. I would gladly give up the job, absolutely love to give it up, if the Spirit of God did not compel me to do it. I'm glad to serve Christ in this. I want you to know that. I'm not saying that I don't like to do this. I mean to say I'm anxious to serve the Lord, but apart from that, nothing but headaches in this job. I mean the troubles of the body, the trouble of trying to teach the Word accurately, and the problem of the fact that I'm responsible for what you get in the Word. It's the fact that I am a responsible shepherd that makes it a hard job, because I care what you hear. It matters to me what happens in your lives. I could just rush out and teach a Bible class some weekday and go on my way, and it'd be a nice academic subject, but it isn't that way. I'm a shepherd, and the Spirit has put some people under my care. And what I say is deeply important. Not just because of the fact of trying to give a lecture to you, but of teaching you truths about the Bible, but because there is this integral connection between what you hear from the Word and what goes on in the life. I bring it all up again because of the fact that there is so much confusing teaching in the church today, from so many quarters. But as I observe a lot of it, it is not a shepherd teaching. It's an academic thing. When people can have seminars and lectureships and Bible classes by the score and miss this deep point that I am saying here. I pointed out to you that it's not because I'm trying to build my own case, because I would set it aside gladly if the Spirit would let me. Because I don't want to tell people what to do. I don't want to have the responsibility of your Spirit. Paul said, if I do it willingly, then I have my reward. But if I do it against my will, then God has given me a job to do. And the Spirit of Christ compels me to do what I'm doing. I'm here because of that. I have my own thoughts of what life is and what the Word is, and I have my own relationship to Christ, and He and I stay on good terms. If we didn't, I wouldn't be here. There's no way that this does anything for me personally. I can't just give you outlines from a textbook. I've got to give you myself. The Word has got to come through me. And if that confidence is not there, if that confidence would not be there on your part in my ministry, then you should be out from under it. So I'm not saying, come to me, I have the answers. I'm saying, let the Spirit direct you to the shepherd, but get your teaching from the shepherd and whatever allied assistance there is. There are ways in which the Lord has gifted members of the body for various things. That is true. But unfortunately, I have to say to you something here. These are difficult days. They are tough days as far as living the Christian life in this world, and Satan is doing his best to confuse the body and to spoil the truths of the Word by the conflicting forces that are coming at us. For young people, for example, to try and maintain a walk that is close to Christ in this day is hard, and parents and those who are responsible for these young people are in a difficult position. If we try to enforce some kind of rule or some kind of regulation, then we lose the heart of the young people. If we don't enforce the regulations, we lose the young people anyway to the world. What do we have to do? We have to sort of strike a rough average. We try to keep enough latitude so we're not putting anybody in a box, but enough firmness so we can give guidance. And it just is hard. Satan is using every device he can to divide the body, to tear the believer away from the fellowship of the body, to distort and confuse, and he distorts things between ourselves, between one another. Yet Satan has a great way of getting into human relationships and stirring everything up. Satan can make a dirt clod look like gold and gold look like a dirt clod. Paul says to the believers then, don't let your good be evil spoken of. I urge upon you, don't be just drinking from every fountain that comes along. The answer, of course, is to stick close to the Word, and also that we approach the Word from the point of view of the Spirit. What does God want us to know about this? And that we approach life from the point of view of what does God want, not what do we want. What does God want? It's an era where there's a lot of positive thinking, and it has invaded the church. The body of believers have been invaded by this. The demand that to really be with Christ, we have to be the recipients of all of these extra goodies. Jesus was not impressed with this positive thinking message. He was a man that was afflicted, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Not for himself. His tears were for the people around him that were afflicted. This positive thinking message goes more with the self-oriented society where everything has to be for self and success is measured by circumstance. And the process of affliction for spiritual growth is set aside for the process of fleshly expansion, see, by acquisitions, by human enjoyments and so forth. So the message is confusing, even in the more or less fundamental circles. All right, now coming back on this, for a responsible, conservative expression of what Ezekiel 1 means, we're directing your attention to the vision of God that is here, but we are saying that this vision of God has its impact upon our daily lives, and it is not just an ethereal, esoteric thing. Now, we talked last week about the eyes in the circles, the rings. We said that the word rings means ramparts, one of its meanings. When it says that their rings were dreadful, he is talking about the ramparts that were awesome. It says that the rings were so high that they were dreadful. The word rings means ramparts. Verse 18, as for their rings, they were so high they were dreadful, and their rings were full of eyes round about them four. So those were the ramparts. But you see God as a citadel. You see God as a rampart, as a refuge, as well as other aspects of His being. There are many aspects of God's being. I think the best way to look at Ezekiel 1, as to look at some of these other visions, is like, oh, let's say a diamond, and every time you turn it, you see a new color in it. If you were to see this as it's not just a dream, it was a vision, but if you were to see it in terms of, say, the dream where things keep changing all the time, you look again and it's something else. Now, sometimes they're ludicrous and sometimes they're terrifying, these dreams. But this was neither ludicrous nor terrifying in the improper sense. But Ezekiel was looking, and every time he looked, he saw another facet. It was as though God was turning. And every turn was a new facet. Now he is an eagle. Now he is a lion. Now an ox. Now a citadel. Now wheels. Every turn was a different facet. We don't need to think there were 150 gods sitting up there looking like something different. Jesus Christ on the earth was an expression of God, a different facet of God that was made known to us. It is difficult for us to see that spiritual realities are much more tangible than physical realities. Spiritual realities are more tangible, really, than physical reality. And that's what Hebrews 11:1 tells us. What is faith? It says faith is the substance of things hoped for. A Greek word, hypostasis, means that which stands under. But under not so much in the sense of foundation as that which stands under in the sense of substance. Now, the illustration I've given before, and is a good one, I think, is a building that has a facade on it of Carrara tile or something like that, or marble. What is the substance of that building? It's the concrete. Now, faith is the substance of the things that we hope for in this world. Because every day of life takes a quarter turn and looks different, usually worse. This week may be a lovely week for you, and next week terrible. You think you've got everything under control and your ideas are in hand and you're sailing along with Christ, and all of a sudden the next week you turn a corner and it's all different again. What is the thing that's holding all of these things together for it? It is that line of faith, which is from God. That line of faith is just as real as that electric current that is flowing, that electromagnetic process. It's just as real. The energies of the universe are more real than the buildings and the objects that we create out of those things. In the same sense, the energy of the Spirit of God within us, in our spirits, bringing faith, is more real than the little goodies that we have around us, or the little things we want the Lord to do for us or to give us. and you can yourself disintegrate as a body, as a being, and your spirit still goes on. Your spirit is the ongoing reality of you, and that spirit is a process of energy, and the Bible uses the word faith to identify it. Faith is that gift of God that gives us the interacting tie between Himself and us. If you see faith only as a feeling of trust about something or a feeling of confidence, you're going to miss it. Because those feelings of confidence come and go. Now, as you see this vision of Christ in the book of Ezekiel, you see a reality there that goes beyond the petty descriptions that we might give of substance. That is to say, here are ramparts, and here are beasts, and here are wheels, and precious stones, and lights, and colors, all of these things, lightning and fire, crystal, which is ice really, all of these things are God manifest to us, but they do not mean a thousand gods, but a thousand facets of God Himself. There is a certain sense in which God is in everything. There is a sense in which the energy of God is the sustaining element of every part of this universe. The pantheist misapplies that, because God is not altogether that. There is God is other than the universe. He is other than the energies of the universe. He is behind the energies of the universe. At the same time, His Spirit is projected into everything in the universe. That is His energy. And they hang together with Him. That's what Colossians 1 tells us. By Him all things consist. That is, they stand together. That's what holds the atoms of the universe together. The presence of the Spirit of God within the universe. Now that is not the same as the presence of the Spirit of Christ within us. I mean, it is to say He's not there in the same sense. The same Spirit, the Spirit of God that created the universe, is the same Spirit. That is to say, the Spirit of God that brooded over the face of the deep is the same Spirit that occupies our spirits. But He occupies us in a vastly different sense than He occupies the essence of the universe around us. So now we gave to you the words that He is the rampart, but in the rampart are the eyes. And we read to you Second Chronicles 16:9 last week. The eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show Himself strong in the behalf of those whose hearts are perfect toward Him. The Lord is sustaining you day by day. He has sustained you all week. You're here this morning because He sustained you. Did you make mistakes? Probably. Did you offend Him? No doubt. You have difficulties with your life, no doubt. Is everything in place? By no means. But you're here. Your heart still yearns for Christ. Your spirit still reaches out for that touch with God. And how else in the world could you explain that except that the Spirit of Christ is in you? Coming to this place, you can't chalk it up to curiosity about religious things. It's not that kind of word we give here. You're not here because you're curious about God. You're here because you have a desire for Christ. You're not here for the music, for the religious atmosphere. You're not here for the quietness, for the quiet devotion. But you are human. You walk a human road. If you try to be super spiritual, you're going to have a lot of trouble, because there's a lot of pride in that, a lot of religious flesh that says to God, I am going to be that perfect one. I'm very concerned about the consecration type meetings where people presumptuously tell God they're going to be great. They're going to be all His. They're going to be all of this and all of that. Why? Because it's ministers to the pride, where you say, Lord, I can't give you any guarantees, but I'm with you. Whatever goes in my life is going to have to go through the power of the Spirit. You'll find I'm not a libertine. I'm not talking to you as what shall I say? Well, a libertine is the best word. We're not lawless. We are not preaching a gospel of freedom to do anything you want. But we want the freedom within you to be developed through the Holy Spirit and not through just religious rituals and regulations. There's an expression called antinomianism. Antinomianism is a label put on people that are regarded as against the law. A good friend of mine was talking to a very well-known theologian in the church who is also a very good friend of mine and a writer of many books. But this theologian said to my friend, "Well, I guess you're an antinomian then." And my friend immediately thought, "Well, wait, I don't mean to stand against the law." And he said, "Well, I don't really mean that." And this theologian said, "Well, that's strange. Paul was an antinomian." And that is true. You know, wherever law becomes the essence of the life, Paul was antinomian. It isn't the law, it's the Spirit that develops our spirits within us to be what God wants us to be. So I just had to throw the point out here. I'm not a libertine. I don't say that people can do anything they want and still please God. I want to provide the matrix in which you are free to develop as the Spirit brings that development about without feeling that the moment you make a mistake, you're going to be thrown out of the ship. Freedom to deal with God in regard to your problems without taking a back seat and saying, "Well, I guess I'm one of the substandard ones in the group because I don't, you know, I still smoke cigarettes or I still do this or I still do that." You know, one may say, "Well, I guess I'm not quite what the rest of them are." And there's much of that in the body. And it's deadly because unless you stay with Christ, you're never going to get help. If what you regard as mistakes is causing you to back away from Christ, you're hopeless. Stay with Him. Stay right in there because He gives you the liberty to do that. All right, I think I'm going to have to stop here.